I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A wonderfully, a really wonderfully engaging book out now is Once They Were Hats in Search of the Mighty Beaver. Whether you regard them as ugly rodent-like creatures or like someone from a previous era, covet their fur for a coat or a hat, beavers are fascinating. This book looks at the millions of years of history of these water and land creatures who were depended upon for the fur trade. Their pelts were highly sought after, leading to endangerment at one point. Castor canadensis, I hope I pronounced that right, has had an integral part in the country's history, its iconography, and our landscape and waterways. Beaver dams are known for their protection of beavers, built with rigor that can result in flooding and flood control. Frances Backhouse is the author of this book, and she joins me in person now to discuss the journeys she's taken to find the beaver and learn about this unique species, whether over time or in their habitats today. It's a well-written book and one that I enjoyed a lot. Frances Backhouse is the author of five books, including Children of the Klondike, which won the 2010 City of Victoria Butler Book Prize. She is a freelance writer and teaches creative nonfiction at the University of Victoria, where she lives. The website for more is at backhouse.ca. The book is published by ECW Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Frances Backhouse. Ms. Backhouse, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
As I said in the introduction, I really enjoyed the book, and I guess I didn't think I would, because I've never really thought of beavers in the way that you have. We think of them as these animals that, you know, dam up rivers and ruin waterways in some instances. They don't look terribly attractive. But the way that you've approached them in terms of looking at them at the part that they play in the ecosystem and then in our history is just a fascinating journey. What turned you on to writing about beavers?
Well, I have a background in biology, and so I came to this originally as a biologist, but I've always been very interested in history too, and I particularly like subjects that allow me to combine my interests in biology and history, and the beaver fits that perfectly because they're so interesting on both sides.
And, I mean, we know them in this country, but they are found elsewhere, aren't they?
Yes, so Castor canadensis is found all over North America, from the Rio Grande up to the Arctic tree line and from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean. That's its original range, but of course at one time they were wiped out of most of that range. And the only other species of beaver in the world is the European beaver, Castor fever, which is found throughout most of Europe.
But none of them have taken on, say, the mythical nature of the Canadian beaver in those other places, say Europe, for example.
That's right. Yes, the beaver is an icon, an unsurpassed icon in Canada.
And do you have an idea of when that started? I mean, going back to say the when even before say white people came to this land, they played an integral part, say, in the ideas that First Nations had about nature, didn't they?
That's right. They were important to a lot of different First Nations. They were clan animals for various First Nations, and even where they didn't have that kind of status, they were very highly regarded because their fur was important. Not so often for clothing, because they have very heavy pelts, so for the more the groups that traveled a lot, they didn't make a lot of, say, coats or big clothing out of beaver fur, but mitts and trim on moccasins, that sort of thing. And there was a recognition of the beaver having such an integral role in creating ecosystems for other species amongst the First Nations.
Just in terms of clothing, we hear of beaver lined coats or full length beaver coats and raccoon caps, mink. In terms of, if you had to compare the furs amongst one another, I mean, it's terribly out of fashion now, mm-hmm. to buy something of that nature. But just in those days, say, beavers were highly coveted, weren't they?
Yes. So because beavers are semi-aquatic animals, their fur is very dense. They have a very dense undercoat to keep them warm in the cold water, and then a layer of long guard hairs over top. So it's a very water-repellent fur and very warm, which makes it excellent for clothing, and that was appreciated by the First Nations.
And the value, I guess, that was worth more than, say, other types of fur?
It varies. You know, some others were also highly regarded, but when they became so valuable was once Europeans arrived on the scene, because they were interested in the pelts for a different reason. They were interested only in that under fur, because it was shaved off the pelt and felted and turned into hats, and hence the title, Once They Were Hats. By the time Europeans showed up in North America in the late 1400s, they had pretty much wiped out their own beavers, and yet there was a huge craze for hats made of felted beaver fur in Europe because of their water-repellent qualities, and because the fur binds very closely and makes a very tight felt. And so they wanted beaver fur for hats. They'd run out of, well, they'd killed off their own beavers, and so all of a sudden they arrived in North America and found this continent full of beavers, and that drove the exploration and settlement of North America. Our history is so closely tied to that beaver fur trade.
So can you get a beaver coat nowadays?
You can get a beaver coat. They are the kind of clothing beaver fur is used for is more, say, jackets or trim because of the heavy weight of it. But you can also get hats made from the felted beaver fur, are made by some specialty hat makers.
I guess you can't farm beavers, say, as you can mink.
Well, some people did try to farm them because they thought that would be the way to have a steady supply, but it's hard to contain beavers. For one thing, if you put up any kind of a wooden fence, they just chew it down. And, they didn't take well to captivity. You can't keep them in cages. They need a wilder habitat, so the various attempts to farm them didn't go anywhere.
How big do these things get? And has that size have their sizes changed, say, throughout history?
The modern beaver, the beaver we know, gets to be about the weight and size of a Labrador Retriever. Although obviously it's a different shape, they're chubbier and they have the long tail, but they're about 3 feet long from nose to tail, and up to about 35, 40 pounds. The weight and size changes geographically. They're bigger in some areas than others, but not a lot. However, there was another species in the past that we call the giant beaver, which was much bigger, about the size of a small black bear.
And just the I guess what do you call that, the teeth, the those are unique altogether, aren't they?
Well, they're like a lot of rodents, their teeth grow continuously, and so
even if they break off, they would grow back again.
Well, if they broke off, yes, they would grow back because they are growing continuously. But the other thing about them growing continuously is if they don't keep chewing on wood, they would get too long. So as they chew, the edges work together to keep them constantly sharp. So the bottom ones are kind of sharpening the top ones as they chew on wood.
So they need to chew on wood. If we think of them as destructive, I mean, they're really, they're not destructive per se, but they need to do that, or otherwise.
They need to do that for the teeth. And of course, that's where they get their food and their building materials.
The fur, obviously a commodity, but the castor as well?
Yes. So the castor is, they have these glands called castor glands that are in the genital region. And they produce a scent component that's used, they use it for territorial marking. But people who make perfume have been using it for thousands and thousands of years as an ingredient in perfume.
Is that still used today?
I mean, yes, it is.
Yeah. You know, when we think of beavers, we think of them obviously from our memory growing up. You know, that we saw them on stamps, on coats of arms. Mm-hmm. So this connection to Canadian identity, which you talk about in the book, is rather fascinating. because it goes back hundreds of years, even before Confederation.
Yes, and our very first postage stamp had a beaver on it, the threepence beaver. And it was the world's first postage stamp that featured an animal rather than the head of a queen or king or a head of state. So it was unusual in that way.
And if you had to pick an animal that defines Canada, I mean, that would be the beaver. I know some people have tried to get polar bears or other animals, you know, to signify the country. But I guess the beaver, generally, by most objective accounts, is it.
Yes, well, people have liked to compare Canadians to the beaver because the beaver is industrious and peaceable and hardworking and a good family animal, and all these traits that we like to attribute to ourselves, we see in beavers as well.
Do they hunt a lot, like other animals?
The beavers?
Yeah.
No, they're purely vegetarians.
Yeah.
But they get hunted.
Yeah. But by whom?
Wolves, bears, wolverines, coyotes. And the reason they build their lodges in the middle of water is to keep away from all those animals, and so they're most vulnerable when they go on land to do their tree cutting.
And these dams and lodges, they're very intricate, aren't they? And they're robust.
Yes, yeah, I talked to one biologist who had a. I can't remember what animal he was wearing. Otters, I think, actually. So he had this otter that had a radio collar on it, and it dropped the radio collar inside a beaver lodge. And so he knew the radio collar was in there. It was a beaver lodge that wasn't being used anymore, and he wanted to get in there. And he said the work it took for him to chop with an axe into this beaver lodge to try and get this radio collar back was tremendous. It was really, really robust, solid construction.
Yeah. One wonders how they get to that. I mean, that's just, I guess that's the nature of it, that they need to survive, and they'll do what they can to survive, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's instinctive. Beavers that are orphaned and raised by humans, once they're put in the environment where they have the building materials and the water, they will build dams and build lodges.
So I guess one of the challenges to its survival over history has been the hunting of and the harvesting for pelts and its fur. Mm-hmm. At one point, they were in danger, weren't they?
Yes. The estimated population of beavers before Europeans came to North America is somewhere between 60 million and 400 million. And by 1900... their numbers were down in the low 100,000s, so they were less than 1% of the original population by 1900. And a lot of people thought they were going to go extinct in the same way that the plains bison had gone extinct or the passenger pigeon. However, they just in time, people started to do things differently and put great restrictions on the trapping, and then started returning them to some of the areas that they had been exterminated from, and the populations did come back.
And I guess because people don't wear fur anymore, that's helped in some regard, hasn't it?
Yes, although there is still a trapping industry, particularly in the north, and beavers aren't worth as much anymore, but a lot of trappers still do trap them. But most of the trapping now is done because people are unhappy with having beavers in their neighborhood because they're causing flooding, they're blocking up culverts and roads, they're cutting down trees that people don't want cut down, all of these things. And so there's a lot of nuisance, quote-unquote nuisance beaver trapping. And certainly it is a real problem for people when they have beavers doing these things, but trapping them and killing them or moving them somewhere else doesn't solve the problem, because if there's good habitat, more beavers just come in the next year. So the better solution has been found to be to actually modify their dams so that they can still live there, but they're not flooding. And this is done by installing what are called beaver bafflers, which are pipes that run through the base of the dam below water level with an intake that's set at the level that you want the water to stay at, and the water flows through the dam in a way that the beavers can't detect and can't plug up the holes, and so they have their habitat. It resolves the flooding problem, and there can be peaceful coexistence.
Yeah, so we can coexist with them, I guess, and we're making the efforts as humans rather than the other way around, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
When you look at, I guess, how close did you get to a dam? Did you?
Oh, I've walked across them, and they're very solid. Yeah, you can walk right across them.
You live in Victoria. I live in Vancouver. In Vancouver today, how close are we to say where a beaver might be?
There's beavers living in Burnaby Lake, I believe. In fact, I think they've had some problems there and had to do some remedial action to coexist with them. There's all around Vancouver Island. They're in most of the habitats where they were before they've come back to now.
You write at the back of the book about some places, I guess, near the Bronx Zoo. One lived there, a couple lived there, didn't they?
Yeah. So in New York, the heart of New York and the heart of the Bronx, they've now taken up residence again, which is interesting because New York was founded on the beaver fur trade as New Amsterdam, and then it had been at least 200 years since there'd been beavers in New York, and one day one of them swam downriver and climbed up on the bank just near the Bronx Zoo, in fact, and made himself a home.
There's one in Toronto, too, I understand.
Yeah, Toronto, and all these big cities where they're kind of the last place we would think of as being beaver habitat, and yet if there's water and there's wood and they're not harassed, they can live there.
Did they have beavers in Stanley Park?
Yes, and that's right.
That's why they call it, I guess, Beaver Lake, right?
Yeah, a bit of a problem there, too. They've had to make some adjustments to things to coexist with them there.
Did you make a lot of trips for this book?
Yes, I traveled as far as Gatineau Park outside of Ottawa, where they're actually the leaders in developing these technologies for coexisting with beavers. Spent some time in Saskatchewan, including hiking into the cabin of that was the home of Grey Owl, who was leading beaver conservationist in the early 1900s. And I went up to the Yukon to speak to a woman who's the matriarch of the Deschutan clan, which is a clan that their clan animal is the beaver. So I got around to as many places as I could, but because beavers are all over the place, there's so many other places I could have gone to.
And when you're up close to one, I mean, I guess you got pretty close to one at the numerous points. What are they like? I mean, you can tell a lot when you're close to an animal, say, human or otherwise.
They're very calm animals. I think that was the thing that really struck me about them is they have this just very kind of calm air, and when they're working on their dams or their lodges, there's just a sort of calm determination as they go about their work. And I would not get too close to one if I was on land and it didn't have an escape route, because they can actually be quite vicious in defending themselves when they feel cornered like that, when they can't get to water. So, but if they're in the water and you're on land, I've had one swimming just a few feet away from me where I've been on the shore and just watching me, making this little sort of, sound that was kind of like a cross between a purr and a growl, just sizing me up.
They're
clever. Very interesting.
They're clever, too. That's the thing that I learned throughout this book. I guess I don't know why I didn't think they were beforehand, but...
Yeah. Yes, they're not... They're not clever in the way that some animals are of being very innovative, but the things that they do, they do very well, and the instincts that have evolved over the generations of how to construct a dam with just the right curve to hold back the water, things like that, where to find building materials, how to improvise if there's no wood around, they... they've really got the engineering down to a T.
And they're useful in terms of how we react to climate change. That's
yes.
something that I never thought of until...
Yes, and not many people were thinking about that until yeah. fairly recently, but because they pond up water, it raises the water table over a large area and keeps water in place. So they're creating open water habitat, they're increasing groundwater supplies, and also mitigating flooding. They can't stop every flood, but they can mitigate the effects of moderate floods.
And so once when we would hunt them, we're now protecting them, and they're part of this struggle against climate change, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they can certainly be our allies in yeah. combating the drought and the extreme rain events and so on that are happening with climate change.
The spiritual nature of beavers is something that you also look at in the book, the relationship with the First Nations, I mean, throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
How did say Indigenous people react to or say lost the word now? What was their relationship like with the beaver? I mean, did they yeah. regard it highly as beavers ought to have been regarded? Say
yes. Well, their relationship with every living creature and non-living creature is so different than the way we relate to the natural world. And even to make that distinction between ourselves and the natural world is antithetical to mm-hmm. how First Nations view the world. And so beavers were simply another member of their community, really. And so many of them, that especially the ones that hunted beaver a lot, had rules about how beavers were treated when they were hunted. Things like returning the bones to the water, which was connected to ideas of reincarnation of the animals, and not allowing dogs to chew on the bones, these sort of things. And the idea was that if you treated the animal respectfully, that it would make itself available to the hunter when the hunter needed that animal for food. And they were a very important food source because the meat is high in protein and it's also very fatty, and that fat is very important in the wintertime when many other animals are very lean and that people needed that fat in their diet.
You talk to many people that have tasted beaver?
Yes, I have talked to a number of people, and
I mean, it's not something you can get at a restaurant. So
no, you can't at all. And so I have not tasted it myself, but yeah. I've talked to other people who have, and it's quite a strong tasting meat, apparently, yeah. and it is fatty, and so it seems to be an acquired taste.
So is that that's much of the hunting that's done now is for food? Same communities up north?
Yeah, or? Up north I'd say it's a combination of food and fur.
Yeah. There's a wonderful line in the book near the end where you say that all beavers leave home to search for their own domain. And mm-hmm. it's terribly wise because it applies not only to beavers, but I guess everyone else, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think because they have a family structure that it has some similarities to human family structure, we can really relate to that. The young ones stay in the lodge with their first of all, the pairs mate for life, and they have a family of kits every year, 2 to 6 kits. And then the teenagers, the 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, stick around and help raise the younger ones until it's time for them to go off and find their own domain.
How long do they live, typically?
They can live up to 15 or so years. Typically, they'd probably live about 8 to 10 years.
Yeah. Going back to the idea of the beaver representing this country, and the sort of, in the book you talk about these efforts to change that. I mean, we've mm-hmm. already touched on the polar bear. Say there was one senator who wanted to do away with that, to change it from the beaver to the polar bear. It remains, doesn't it? Just this great symbol for our country.
Yes, I think it's interesting where there's a lot of other countries that have chosen birds of prey like the eagle.
Yeah.
or animals like the lion, you know, fierce animals. And it does say something about Canada that our iconic animal, our national animal, is a builder rather than a destroyer. I think that sort of speaks to the Canadian nature.
And at Gatineau Park, I guess that's close to, I've never been in that part of the world, but that's close to Harrington Lake where the Prime Minister lives.
Yes,
right?
Harrington Lake is actually in Gatineau Park. Yeah.
Okay, so, and there is a great beaver population there?
Yes, yes. Because of this policy of coexistence that they developed, that park is just full of beavers, and yet there's no conflicts because they have all these beaver bafflers, so there's no flooding of the roads. They have a lot of trees there, so there's no problem with the beavers cutting down too many trees. But it's a great place to go and see beavers.
Hey, well, what's the population? Would it be like thousands, tens of thousands, or
thousands? Yeah.
And their future today. I mean, that's insured because we are working to conserve them, right?
Yes. In most places, beaver populations are not under threat now, but unfortunately, in a few places in the United States, such as Rocky Mountain National Park, the population is in trouble because of changes to the ecosystem where it's reached a kind of a tipping point that beavers weren't there, the landscape has changed, and it's not easy now for beavers to bring it back to what it was originally. And so whether beaver populations will survive in those places does still remain in question.
In the course of researching this book, you've obviously read a lot, not only gone to these places where you've seen them and talked to people who are in the conservation field, but just in terms of the mythology of it, in reading, say, Grey Owl or David Thompson, mm-hmm. There must have been a great deal of literature on mm-hmm. beavers from people in the past.
Yes, and I had never read Grey Owl's books before I started researching this book. I'd been sort of dismissive of him. I really thought he was kind of an archaic character and really didn't have anything to say to me. But he writes beautifully, and he had such a passion for the beavers. He writes in an old-fashioned way, but they're really wonderful books, and so I would recommend his
yeah,
books.
And Thompson talks about just seeing thousands and
yes.
hundreds of thousands.
Yes, and David Thompson's journals from his time traveling across Canada when he was mapping Canada in the 1800s, it's fascinating to see that very early view. And when he talks about coming to this beaver dam somewhere on the prairies, it's not really clear where, that was wide enough that he could lead his two horses side by side across this dam, and it was a mile long. It's amazing to think of that. But this man was a surveyor, and so when he says something is a mile long, you can trust his estimation of that.
You teach full-time at UVic?
I'm teaching full-time there right now, yes.
Yeah. Does that leave you much time to say, write books like this? Or
no. So the last couple of years I was teaching part-time there and finishing up the book. And, teaching full-time, I wouldn't be able to be working on a book like this right now.
Yeah. How long did this take once they were hats?
It came together over about 5 years. It was quite a long project. There were because of a number of research trips.
It sounds like it's also a great travelogue, I must say, mm-hmm. in terms of going to these places that I would never have otherwise gone to or even thought to have gone to. And you write it in such an engaging way that it, as I said, it made me just fascinated with this animal, with this creature that means a lot more than it otherwise would have, and not just because it's represented Canada so well in Alps for so long.
Yes. Doing beaver research became a great focus for traveling. It took me to places I wouldn't have gone to either, and that was a lot of fun.
And the sexual connotation of that word, the slang, I always thought that was something of the recent phenomenon, but in the book I learned that it goes back about 100 years?
It goes back to the 1920s, yes. Yeah, I was surprised to learn that too. So many interesting things that I learned.
Yeah, it is a terribly engaging book. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it. It's been a pleasure meeting you today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
The website from our backhouse.ca. The book is called Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver. It's published by ECW Press. It's author Francis Backhouse joining me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.